It's the Class Teaching Podcast with James Crane.
Welcome to the Class Teaching Podcast, the Durrington Research School podcast. It aims to explore educational research and provide insights into how being an evidence-informed practitioner can support teaching and learning. Educational research does not provide a silver bullet, but coupled with teacher expertise, it can provide us with tried and tested approaches that the evidence suggests may lead to promising outcomes. In each episode, we will draw upon the experience of a teacher with a particular expertise in the area we are looking at. Durrington High School is a large coastal secondary comprehensive school based in West Sussex and has been designated a research school by the Education Endowment Foundation. You can follow us on Twitter at Durring Research. The purpose of this podcast is to help busy teachers like you connect with the latest thinking around ideas in teaching. In an accessible and easy format, we realise there is a wealth of blogs being published every week. The Class Teaching Podcast will start with me reading a blog and then spending some time with the author unpicking their thinking. This way you can listen on the drive to work or while walking the dog, rather than having to find the time to sit down in front of your screen during a busy day. How Reliable Are Your Assessments? By Ben Crockett. I recently ran a session as part of one of our training programs around the topic of assessment. As part of this, I discussed with delegates the factors and strategies we can use to affect the reliability of any assessment we undertake. For any secondary colleagues listening to this, this topic is of particular pertinence as we all work towards assigning accurate and valid teacher-assessed grades. Much of what I discussed on the training program stemmed from a fantastic resource recently published by Evidence-Based Education Association, outlining their four pillars of assessment: purpose, reliability, validity, and value. Reliability is essentially about the accuracy and consistency of an assessment and the inferences we draw from them. There are many factors that contribute to the reliability of an assessment, but perhaps most critical are the precision of the questions or tasks asked, plus the accuracy and consistency of the interpretations derived from the responses we collate. What we must consider or accept is that no assessment will ever be 100% reliable, but that by understanding it, we can act towards improving it. One of the most significant ways to improve reliability is to focus on rater reliability, basically the accuracy and consistency of the marking. Rater reliability can be considered in two contexts: inter-rate reliability, i.e. across subject teams, and intra-rater reliability, i.e. in individuals' own consistency. The latter of these two is often overlooked. We acknowledge that achieving consistency across individuals is challenging, especially when the material being assessed is inherently subjective, such as English literature, history, and art, and therefore often allocate considerable time to minimise this. However, we rarely stop to consider the factors that may affect our own consistency. It is not a giant step of logic to realise that our decisions, and therefore grading of assessments, may vary depending on the time of day, our workload, our emotional state, previous lesson experience, and even how hungry we are. As such, despite the pressures we face around assessment points, particularly the current teacher assessed grade situation, that we take time to reflect and monitor our own capacity to be reliable. Inter-rater reliability is inherently challenging. However, the evidence-based education report does highlight some ways we can improve it, using exemplar student work to clarify what success looks like in specific assignments, blind marking assignments to reduce bias, blind moderating samples of students' work, using well-crafted closed multiple choice questions. Based on these suggestions, I've been talking to some of our curriculum leaders at Durrington to find out how they approach the standardisation and moderation of assessments. In geography, Sam Atkins selects 2 to 3 papers from the cohort, covering a range of student types, and ensure all staff have copies of this for standardisation. All team members meet to mark these papers together with either Sam or one of the experienced exam markers in the team, which we're fortunate to have several of, taking the lead of advising on the definitive mark. For each of the longer answer questions, a clear set of criteria for level marking is established, and staff can use the copied papers as yardsticks. Staff are then encouraged to mark question by question rather than the whole paper at a time, allowing for understanding of the mark scheme to be refined and comparative judgments to be made. Once all staff have completed their marking, they return their scripts to Sam. Sam then randomly selects papers from each teacher, plus any they have flagged as being unsure, and these are moderated. Where common errors or issues are flagged, these are recorded and sent out to all the members of staff asking to recheck their papers for these particular issues. In PE, Tom Pickford follows a similar approach to that above. A key part of the team's discussions when awarding marks or grades for extended writing is to ensure a consistent understanding of each level within the mark scheme. The standardised answers are given a grade, and the reasons why this is neither of the adjacent levels is clearly outlined. This process of marking the success criteria explicitly is a vital part of ensuring high reliability. In English, Andy Tharby and Jackie Bradley create a booklet of answers across the grade range. The team then meet to discuss why each example has achieved the grade it has, and therefore the differences between each, and then use this as reference in their own marking. Andy and Jackie then sample a selection of each team member's marking and give individual feedback. Once grades have been awarded and entered into the system, they then review the data looking for any anomalies when compared to a student's historical data. If any anomalies are identified, then the student's assessment is also moderated. Finally, in maths, statistically one of the most reliable subjects for assessment due to the closed nature of the majority of questions, Shane Borrer has been trialling a new strategy in an attempt to further improve reliability and remove any potential for teacher bias. When marking their most recent set of Year 11 assessments, Shane allocated questions across the higher and foundation paper to individual staff members. Each staff member was responsible for marking the same set of questions, approximately a double page spread of questions, for every paper completed, before moving the papers on to the next member of staff to mark the next double page spread, and so on until the papers were fully marked. The benefit of this is that staff can become highly familiar with their section of the mark scheme and are able to make comparative judgments from paper to paper. Furthermore, as they are marking students they do not teach, there is reduced risk of bias. When speaking to Shane about this approach, it was clear he felt it had helped improve accuracy and consistency of marking. However, he did admit that the approach had some drawbacks. Primarily, as a staff were not marking their own class assessments, nor the whole paper, it was harder for them to get a feeling of how their students had done and where they needed to improve. While this was not a significant issue for the final set of Year 11 assessments, it could be more problematic for interim assessments that would normally be used not only summatively, but also formatively to inform future teaching. So I'm joined now by Ben Crockett, who's one of the Research School Associates and also the line manager of Geography and Social Moral Education and Citizenship here at Durrington High School. So thank you for joining me, Ben.
No worries.
I just thought I'd start with, obviously we're talking about assessments. I just thought, as we do with most of the podcast, is just look at the opening thoughts of the relevance of this at present right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that probably speaks for itself at the moment, doesn't it? You know, for any of secondary colleagues listening at the moment, you know, taking on the role of teacher and examiner to a degree at the moment, and obviously most of us have either in the process of or have already completed assessments with our exam year groups, and obviously wanted to ensure that that data that we're using to make those decisions, which obviously incredibly important at the moment, is as reliable and as robust as possible. And I just think the conversation is having with other leaders at the moment just centres around that, about how do we ensure that what we're assessing and the inferences and the decisions we make from that are based on the strongest data possible.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of stuff on data in terms of reliability and validity. But the post and the Association for Evidence-Based Education, the four pillars, obviously, of purpose, validity, reliability and value, just seem a really, really important place to start. What was it that sort of made you focus the blog around the reliability pillar?
I think, well, a part of it came out of me and Sean are currently running the curriculum teaching assessment training course here at Durrington Research School, and you know, we were talking to delegates about actually probably the two central pillars there of reliability and validity. And you know, to be fair, it was a bit of a kind of sort of flip of a coin of which one I was going to write about on this one. And I think both of them are incredibly important. However, I felt that as quite a large number of the assessments had already been drawn up by staff at Durrington, so probably colleagues in other schools as well, that actually at this point validity is more going to be talking about what you're going to include in your assessment, about the construct of your assessment. I actually felt that probably more practically at the moment, people would be interested in how they ensure reliability.
Yeah, and I think one of the really good areas, or one of the really interesting bits that made me think about within the blog, obviously we spoke about the inter-rate reliability in terms of within subject teams, and there seems to be a lot of work on sort of moderation of assessments in terms of everyone working together. And what are your thoughts on the intra-rate reliability? Because obviously that is something that I hadn't necessarily thought too much about, so I just wanted to sort of pick your brain on that.
Really. Yeah, I mean, obviously, so you mentioned earlier, but the evidence-based education sort of document that they just recently released is a fantastic kind of very quick read to go to, and they do talk about this idea of reliability and basically break it down into two concepts. You said inter and intra, and they talk about how intra reliability is quite often overlooked. You know, we do spend a huge amount of time in all phases, from primary up to secondary, making sure that we have that inter-rate reliability where we work together to standardise and moderate. But I think it can be quite easy for us to overlook our own consistency from one paper to the next. You know, it's not, as I've put in the blog, it's not a massive step of logic to realise that when you've had a stressful day or a bad lesson or you're tired or there's, you know, we're all busy people and we're juggling other things, that is likely to impact on our performance, and it's likely to impact on the decisions that we make. And we have to be very careful that we therefore in the right frame of mind, that we don't have any of those kind of external pressures, or we can put those external pressures to one side. Bias, you know, yeah, that we don't take into consideration what we know about that student from a lesson that they had, that maybe they've had a bad lesson, and therefore that impacts on how we mark their assessment. I just think it gets overlooked. So I think we spend a huge amount of time in teams trying to make sure we're as consistent as possible with each other, but can quite often forget being consistent for ourselves. One of the big things that I always recommend to anybody for that is that you mark, put in the blog, you mark question by question on any assessment, so that you're not looking at a student, you're not kind of going, you know, oh, it's that student, you know, they're really good, or they just probably had a bit of a bad day on this, and therefore you maybe subconsciously be more positive towards them or negative towards them. That if you're marking question by question, that kind of makes it a blind marking, that you're not seeing the name of the student, and also it gives you that opportunity to become much more consistent in your marking. You're able to make those comparison judgments from one paper to the next. You become much more familiar with the mark scheme. And as a result of that, maths department, I put towards in the blog that Shane Borrett, the critical media of maths, he's trialled something for this set of assessments where the team have actually marked basically a double page spread. And, you know, one teacher for the higher paper, for example, has taken questions 1 to 4 and has marked everybody's 1 to 4. Then that pile's been moved on to the next teacher, then marked 4 to 8, and so on. So again, you're taking out that opportunity for kind of bias through marking your own students' work, and giving the teachers that opportunity to become really, really expert in that mark scheme.
Yeah, and one of the things that you said in terms of with Shane was that one of the potential issues looking at this as a sort of moving forward, not just with the Year 11 assessments at the moment, but across all the assessments, is that he said it might be a problem with identifying, sort of getting a feeling for how the students had done or where they needed to improve. How do you see that sort of becoming, sort of overcoming that barrier in terms of the formative assessment or the formative use of the summative assessment?
I mean, I think that is the issue, isn't it? We're looking at these assessments at this point, for any Year 11, Year 13 stuff out there, you know, these are a very summative assessment. You know, there's no real intention of using them particularly formatively for those year groups. However, you know, with most assessments, whether they're summative or not, we want to be able to use them formatively to inform our future teaching. And obviously, once you take the marking out of the particular teacher sort of hands, that there becomes that detachment from it. You know, some of the ways that I suppose you could look at getting around it is kind of just like formative assessment logs. I know, for example, we've talked about, and you've kind of talked about, Chris Runicles has used kind of like formative assessment books where teachers just note down common misconceptions or errors as they mark, and then maybe sharing that as a team. So when you come back together after everybody's marked their individual sections, that you come back together and go, right, on the papers that, on the section of the paper that I marked, I noticed X, Y, and Z was poorly done. And obviously that's going to inform you. It's never going to be quite as perfect as a class teacher mark.
No, and I think with that, you weigh up the
the reliability of the assessment,
exactly,
the moderation process, and then the sort of the discussion you can then have as a team around those areas is potentially really fruitful.
And I mean, the issue with reliability, it's always a bit of a tug of war with everything else. You know, if we wanted full reliability, we'd have complete blind marking, we would have closed questions, multiple choice, where, you know, there's no chance of it being of sort of interpretation. It's, you know, wrong or right. But that pulls in one direction, whereas, as we talked about, things about being able to formatively assess and know where your students are, the validity of your assessment. So, you know, does it assess everything that you wanted it to? You know, validity pulls in the direction of being open and authentic. So open questions, opportunity for students to really show off their knowledge. Reliability pulls in the completely different direction of closed questions, making it really tight so that there's much easier to mark or much more easy opportunity to be consistent. And the problem is, as soon as you start trying to increase reliability, you're going to lose validity. You're going to lose that ability to maybe use it formatively to a degree. You've got to find the happy medium, the sort of middle point, and accept that it's never going to be perfect. You know, the education sort of document there talks about both of them. It says you can never have 100% validity or 100% reliability. You've got to accept that, and actually accepting that you can't have that, and working out where's your happy medium or kind of hunting ground for that, is what you need to work on.
Yeah, and obviously for your subject areas that are far more subjective, like your English literature, history, it is a little bit more tricky to do,
yeah.
Which is why this process, or the process of looking at inter-rate reliability and intra-reliability,
and
is huge.
I didn't mention it, Bob, but something that I use quite often is the Ofqual document that they produced back in 2016, where they looked at consistency of marking across sort of individual components for exams. So they weren't looking at total grade, but for example, in a geography exam, you know, what was the chance of an examiner giving the same mark as the senior examiner on paper one of the three modules? And, you know, despite all the training that the exam boards do and you have to go through to become an examiner, there was still a huge variability there. You know, the probability of this same grade being given quite high in subjects like maths, which is perhaps not unsurprising. But yeah, when you said you get to your more subjective subjects, your English literature, language, history, the probability really was quite low. And again, that was something that you have to accept. And they pointed out this wasn't a criticism of the marking and so on. You know, in most cases, it was something like 96% of the time, you were always going to get either the grade or the adjacent one either side. But even with all that huge amount of work that goes into making sure examiners are as well-trained as possible, and there's all the checks, you've still got that chance of it not being 100% reliable as soon as you get into your subjective topic. So we have to accept that, and our plan, you know, we need to work towards minimizing that rather than, you know, eradicating. You can't eradicate it. It exists and it will always exist, but you need to think about what can I do, what strategies, what things can I put in place that minimize that chance of variability.
Yeah, and I think that's a really useful thing to think about, and not look at it from I need to eradicate this, because you can become bogged down in it. One of the things I just wanted to look at was, you mentioned in there the use of exemplary student work in terms of clarifying what success looks like in specific assignments. As a former curriculum leader and now online manager, how have you sort of done that? Obviously, they've got the examples in, but I just wanted to your own personal experience.
I think one of the really important things there is making sure that when you standardise as a team, that you have an array of the assessments across different grades or whatever your mark for GCSE grades or thresholds at Key Stage 3 and so on. That then firstly allows for that comparative judgment to be made. And I know P talk about this, but that idea of really spending time detailing exactly what is the difference between each one. So not just this is a, you know, if we're taking GCSE ones, as that's probably relevant, this is a grade 5. Piece of work, this is a grade 7, what is it that makes the significant difference between those, and that they need to be really explicit to staff, you know, and almost like a set criteria that the reason this isn't a grade 7 is because of X, Y, Z. And that discussion, making sure that everybody has that clarity within your team, is really, really vital, I think, to get your marking as reliable as possible.
In practical subjects, thinking of the ones that I'm involved with in terms of drama and PE, as two of them, is what they do is they'll give you like a band. So I think one of the things that is really beneficial in terms of looking at reliability of assessment is, in terms of within that band, what do the different sub-levels look like within it? And like you say, I think getting those explicit and spending a lot of time prior to looking at sort of assessments and where kids are, it's ironing out exactly what it is and being really sort of explicit within the teams that this is this grade because of this, 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 and this. And then using those as almost yardsticks, like you said, with geography.
I think one of the biggest issues for reliability is vagueness. You know, as soon as you kind of have it's a little bit kind of, you know, just grey areas, it becomes so much more difficult to ensure that people are going to be on the same page. So yeah, if you can be explicit, really clear, you know, I put the example in there, the English department, where basically Andy and Jackie create a booklet of virtually examples of every single potential grade.
Yeah.
Now, of course, it's not perfect, because not every student can write exactly the same, but it gives you that opportunity to be as tight as possible.
Yeah, really important. Obviously, this the Evidence-Based Education Association, four pillars of assessment, is a really useful place to start. I'm currently looking or going through again the Dylan William and Better Formative Assessment book. Would you say there's any other sort of really useful places if people wanted to explore a little bit further?
You just said the Dylan William stuff is always one that I kind of look to go to. Michael Charles has also done some quite interesting work on kind of feedback pendulum, and then there he talks about assessment as well.
The 12-page report or outline of the four pillars in terms of a resource guide definitely gets you thinking about assessment. If we're looking at assessment as the bridge between teaching and learning, if teaching is what you want the students to know, learning is what they have remembered or retained, and assessment is the way of doing that, I think that's a really useful place to start those discussions as we finish with the year 11s and 13s, but as we also look to more robust, rigorous assessment across our settings. So thank you very much for joining me, Ben, as ever. It was very thought-provoking.
Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Class Teaching Podcast by Durrington Research School.
It's the Class Teaching Podcast with James Crane.